On the program today, airplanes, jobs, farming, and astronomy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 6th day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, did you hear the one about Boeing and the president-elect of the United States of America?
It's going to be over $4 billion. It's for Air Force One program. And I think it's ridiculous. I think Boeing is doing a little bit of a number. We want Boeing to make a lot of money, but not that much money.
That was Mr. Trump this morning in his eponymous tower, following up on a tweet in which he said, and I quote, "Boeing is building a brand new 747 Air Force One for future presidents, but costs are out of control, more than $4 billion. Cancel order." Now, a couple of things. First of all, yes, the lead story today is about a tweet. It has to be said, though, that that's the way industrial policy in this economy now seems to be being made. So we are going to cover said tweets. Second of all, though, facts matter, no matter what many people are saying. So here are some about Boeing, Air Force One, and governing by tweet. Fact number one, Boeing and the federal government right now are $170 million with an M dollars into a contract for design and evaluation of the new Air Force One. Item two, Mr. Trump is close to right about the total price, though the GAO says all in, the new presidential planes will cost about $3.2 billion. But that is for two planes. Item and fact number three, they are not just any planes. Here's Gregory Sanders. He's at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
You're buying a top of the line, literally best in the world system for the president to be able to command a war from air and refuel in air if need be. You know, if some of that's not important to you, okay. But there's a reason it costs $4 billion.
Fact number four, Mr. Trump's tweet this morning came exactly 22 minutes after the Chicago Tribune posted a story in which Boeing's CEO said mean things about the president-elect's trade policies. So there you go. Elsewhere in Trump Tower today, Mr. Trump met with Rex Tillerson. He is the CEO of ExxonMobil and reportedly a candidate to be Secretary of State. Marketplace's Adam Allington has more now on the economic portfolio of America's top diplomat.
Trump's list of candidates is long, and their backgrounds varied. They include a former ambassador to the UN, an ex-mayor, a general, and a businessman. But given Trump's strong economic focus, will the new secretary have to be more deal-maker than diplomat? Jim Sasser, former ambassador to China under President Clinton, says business has always been part and parcel of foreign policy.
During my tenure, there was always a focus on trade and developing economic benefits for both countries.
Sasser worked with Secretary Madeleine Albright to open up a General Motors factory in Shanghai. But if the Secretary of State's job is to represent the U.S. position on international affairs, could the president-elect's tendency to fire off messages over Twitter make the job harder?
It's a dance. The communication of these signals and words matter.
Elizabeth Saunders is a visiting fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She says America First may play well on the campaign trail, but foreign policy isn't just economics.
A question is whether it's the only part that Trump is really going to emphasize, and I think that is a major question that those on the national security front are perhaps more concerned about.
But Trump's tweets might also be part of a broader strategy, so says Philip Lowhouse of the American Enterprise Institute.
You know, some kind of ambiguity needs to be built into expectations.
Basically, keeping them guessing could give the U.S. a tactical advantage in our foreign dealings. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
There is a lot of talk of late, thanks in part to Mr. Trump's tweets, see also our lead story, about what the American relationship with China is going to be like in the Trump years. One can't know the future, of course, but the fact is that the Chinese and American economies are closely joined, perhaps inextricably at this point and on a great many different levels. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gives us a rundown on that.
One way in which China and the U.S. are bound together is through our debt. China owns $1 trillion worth.
They are the largest foreign owner of U.S. debt, particularly Treasury debt.
Nicholas Lardy is with the Peterson Institute. But this isn't necessarily all that important.
I don't think that gives them too much leverage. The Treasury market is extremely large, extremely broad, extremely deep.
He says even if China sold off a bunch of treasuries, the effect would be minimal. More important is what we sell to one another. Clara Gillespie is a senior director at the National Bureau of Asian Research.
the Chinese market is now a $400 billion market for the United States.
Soybeans, aircraft, and passenger vehicles are the top three things we sell to China. It's almost on par now with our second largest trading partner, Mexico. U.S. companies make a lot of products in China, too, and recently China started to invest in the U.S.
Chinese investment in the United States this year will hit about $30 billion. There are now about 90,000 full-time individuals employed in the United States by Chinese-affiliated firms.
Lastly, we buy almost a half a trillion dollars worth of stuff from China each year. David Dollar is at the Brookings Institution.
Electronic appliances, cell phones, computers, refrigerators.
And parts we use to make our own exports. It's anyone's guess at this point whether or how much the U.S.-China relationship may deteriorate, but a great deal of economic activity is at stake. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
As happens every time there is political turnover in Washington, corporate America is trying to figure out how it's going to fare over the next 4 years. So it's perhaps no surprise that Google has posted a vacancy for a manager of conservative outreach. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has the story of tech lobbying.
Not all that long ago, tech companies shied away from Washington. But law professor Mark Lemley at Stanford University says their attempts to build closer ties really took off under the Obama administration.
A lot of folks in the Silicon Valley community were supporters of Obama.
Lemley says PayPal co-founder and Trump supporter Peter Thiel notwithstanding, there are fewer connections between Silicon Valley and the incoming president, and some expect challenges.
At least based on the election campaign, there may be a divergence in perspective.
Dean Garfield heads the Information Technology Industry Council, a tech trade group whose members include Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and others. Garfield says immigration will be a big issue. Trump wants to rein it in, and the tech sector relies on it for brain power. Another possible challenge, net neutrality, the idea that internet service providers shouldn't charge extra for fast lanes on the internet. Garfield's member companies want an open internet. He expects Trump may want to scrutinize the rules they favor.
Each administration, no matter what administration it is, wants to put their stamp on key issues.
But where Garfield says tech companies stand to gain under Trump, tax reform, possibly a more hands-off approach to regulating self-driving cars. And Mark Lemley says Google could benefit on the antitrust front.
Google might reasonably look at a Trump administration and think that they are less likely to be challenged by the government for monopolization.
So there's lots to keep a conservative outreach manager at Google or other tech firms busy. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Random investment item of the day. Jason Miller, the president-elect's spokesman, said this morning on a conference call that Mr. Trump sold all of his stocks back in June. Two things about that. One, remember, he's a real estate guy, mostly hard assets, not equities. Two, if this is true, because there has been no proof offered, but if it is true, the president-elect missed the whole post-election bounce, which is some kind of ironic, right? Wall Street Today was up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Last Friday, the latest jobs report was delivered to us by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The unemployment rate, you might remember, fell to 4.6%, the lowest it's been in 9 years. But that's not really a number that tells us a whole lot about the human experience of working a job in this economy, of climbing the ladder and making a living and just getting by. That latter bit is the subject of a new project from The Atlantic. It's called Inside Jobs, interviews with people about their jobs, from school lunch servers to investment bankers to parking garage owners. Adrian Green is one of the editors on the project. She was in our Washington, D.C. bureau. Adrian, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Give me the nuts and bolts, first of all, I guess. I mean, how did you do? Did you go out and talk to people? Did you sit down and pick up the phone? What'd you do? How'd you find all these folks?
We wanted to get a really diverse set of people in a bunch of different occupations. So we started with the large categories listed in the labor report.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kind of reached out to people that we thought would represent interesting shifts according to kind of what those reports were saying. So, for example, healthcare is an industry that is supposed to grow at a greater than average pace over the course of the next 10 years. So we wanted to make sure that we talked to the kinds of people that represented those changes and hear about what those changes mean to their actual lives.
Do they have common themes, these folks?
Absolutely. They were kind of themes that we recognized as obvious ones that you would see, like work-life balance. Mm-hmm. But the ones that we found the most interesting were kind of the ones where they could be applied to life at large, right? What it was like to adapt to change when your industry changed around you, or what it was like dealing with people. One of my favorite interviews was with a janitor, and he kind of equated...
At Harvard, right?
At Harvard, yeah. Of all places, right. Kind of equated people's ability to kind of think about where they're throwing their trash, like, oh man, I missed the trash can, to like how much respect that people have for, you know, his occupation and the fact that he has to be the person that goes up behind and cleans up behind people that might not even think about, you know, who he is, or the fact that that makes up a majority of his day.
There was a McDonald's manager, I think, in Ames, Iowa, right? A college town?
Yes.
And she's like, yeah, you know, maybe I'll be in food service in 10 years. Maybe I won't.
Yeah, well, her story was particularly interesting because I think that her peer group had gone to college and were pursuing what she considered the quote-unquote real careers, and that they kind of looked at the work that she did as vastly differently or much more temporary as the things that they were striving towards because they chose the path of going to college. And I think that that's, you know, something that a lot of people encounter or struggle with when they decide to or not to pursue different types of occupations.
So now you've got your 100. You've got lawyers and engineers and Python wranglers and obituary writers. Are you going to keep going? Are you going to go overseas? What are you going to do?
For right now, getting over the 100 hump was definitely the main focus. I think that Beret, obviously being a business reporter, will continue.
Yeah, Beret Lamb, your co-author on this piece. Yeah.
Yes. My great colleague will continue to do a lot of great work. And on the project side, I'm really interested in what the American people have to say about a variety of topics, whether it's about their work or just about anything else.
Has this changed the way you think about your job?
Absolutely. I would describe myself as a pretty ambitious person, and I dedicate a lot of time and energy toward my work. And this project has kind of made me realize that work is not all that makes a person. It is the standard by which we are kind of organized and into a hierarchy and kind of the way that a lot of people make meaning. But I think learning from the people that don't get their self-worth from that or don't derive the same type of meaning from their jobs was the most inspiring part. Like, we can make a life that has nothing to do with our jobs, or it can be everything and it can be just as fulfilling.
Adrienne Green is an editor at The Atlantic. Her project with her colleague Beret Lamb is called Inside Jobs. Adrienne, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
One thing the current or even the imagined new Air Force One can't do, no matter how much it costs, fly faster than the speed of sound. Virgin Atlantic has announced it's put an option on 10 supersonic airplanes. Options because the planes don't technically exist yet. Boom, a company based out of Colorado, says it's working on them and they will be ready for testing next year. But does anybody remember the Concorde? Sally Herships has that one.
Sure, the Concorde may have come and gone, but that doesn't mean the dream of supersonic travel is dead. That's according to Mike Boyd, president of the Boyd Group, an aviation consulting firm.
That would be like telling Charles Lindbergh, don't try flying across the Atlantic. 8 people have tried it. They splattered themselves.
Robert Mann is an airline industry analyst. He says supersonic flight enthusiasts, sorry, you may need to come back to Earth.
Well, it's been here. It's seen its day, and it may be gone forever.
Mann says going fast is a physics problem, but that is not the hard part.
The issue isn't technological feasibility. It's economics.
He says speed costs money, and not many customers can afford it, which means the market is a small one. And he says it could cost billions to design and build a new kind of plane. So it could be tough to create the kind of demand engine and airframe manufacturers need, especially since Boom isn't the only company getting into the business.
The issue, I guess, and by the way, I wouldn't call my company Boom, even if I wasn't a supersonic company.
The boom that supersonic planes make is now illegal when flying over land. Boom, the company, says the noise its jets will make is quiet, like a car door slamming. Also, it will start with flights just over water. When it comes to ticket price, Boyd says they won't be sky high. Fares will be about the same as business or first class today. So the customers that companies like Boom needs would just need to be reseated on one of the new planes. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And he even reached out to women who had real background in astronomy, but no place to apply that background.
Cracks in the glass ceiling a very long time ago. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 35 points today, about a 10%, 19,251. The NASDAQ up 24 points, about 0.4%, 5,333. And the S&P 500 added 7 points, 0.3%. Ending at 22.12. Boeing share price hit some turbulence after that Donald Trump tweet we told you about. $4.1 billion in market cap disappeared. By the close, though, it had recovered, ending pretty much flat. From presidential luxury now to knees under the chin, Coach, Alaska Air Group, also known as Alaska Airlines, won antitrust approval today for its $2.6 billion purchase of Virgin America. If it scales back some code sharing and other stuff, Alaska Airlines shares lifted 2%. Virgin America up 0.6%. Bond prices up as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is never easy being a farmer. Even if the weather cooperates, there is so much else that can go wrong. Case in point, Washington and Idaho wheat farmers who are struggling this year because of a crop problem and low prices that they are getting for their grain at market. Anna King from the Northwest News Network explains what's going wrong.
Outside Oaksdale in Washington state, the wind-blown Palouse Hills roll out. Baby green wheat, turned over earth, and golden stubble create the patchwork. Larry Brown's plowing.
I've had problems. We've all had problems with falling numbers in the past, but nothing this severe and this widespread.
Falling numbers means there are enzymes in a kernel of wheat that have eaten away at the starch. That happens when there's rain late in the season or there are wild temperature swings in the summer. It hasn't been this bad here since the early 80s. When wheat doesn't have enough starch, it affects the baking quality. And so bakers in places like Japan won't buy it.
You haul it to the elevator and they tell you it's worthless.
Brown's 85,000 short of breaking even. And a large swath of Washington and Idaho farmers have problems too.
Unfortunately, one kernel with low falling number can bring down a much larger batch of wheat, which is why this is such a problem.
That's Alicia Kazonis. She's a federal research biologist here at Washington State University's Federal Western Wheat Quality Lab.
This is where we do our baking of cakes, cookies.
All this good-smelling baking is purely for science. This year, the lab will make 4,500 batches of Japanese sponge cakes and noodles, testing for quality. The Philippines, Japan, and other Asian countries are the Northwest's top wheat customers. Asian sponge cake is supposed to be light, fluffy. But much of this year's wheat is making stuff that's
dense, they're small.
And that won't cut it in Japan.
No, that is highly unacceptable.
About 40% of the soft white wheat tested so far has low falling number problems. A lot of Northwest wheat winds up at this grain cooperative in Genesee, Idaho. This is where it comes before being sold across the globe. Sammy White manages grain coming in and going out. One of the big problems with this low falling number wheat...
We didn't know who had problems, who didn't have problems, so they were all going into these big silos.
Now White has millions of bushels of grain all mixed up, and it will all fetch a lower price. Some may end up as cattle food.
Realistically, there probably will be a few guys that will be put out of business because of it, and that's tough.
It's tough even if they survive. Farmer Brown says wheat growers have already had some lean years. He won't be buying new harvesting equipment, and he's even cutting back on fertilizer for the next year.
This is where you really just bear down and you'll go without.
He says it's time to turn the wet earth over, put this year behind his plow. Outside of Oaksdale, Washington, I'm Anna King from Marketplace.
There's a new book out about women in science. Women in science a long time ago, but from whom there's a pretty straight line to women in science and technology today. It's about, and this is from the subtitle, The Ladies of Harvard Observatory. So it's about astronomy. It's called The Glass Universe. It's by David Sobel. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We ought to start, I suppose, with some introductions. Edward Pickering and Anna Draper, right? Who were they?
Edward Pickering was the director of the Harvard College Observatory. And Anna Draper was a New York heiress, the wife of Dr. Henry Draper, and she was also his partner in his amateur astronomy pursuits.
And she gives a not small gift that sort of sets off this whole thing, right?
So as a memorial to him, she gave Pickering pretty much the equal of his entire annual budget just to do that project.
And Edward Pickering, in the 1880s-ish, hires women to do this when women just were not in science, full stop.
That's true. He was very broad-minded, forward-thinking. He actually found about six women working at the observatory when he took it over in 1877. And he thought that was just fine. And he even reached out to volunteers, women who had been through one of the women's colleges and had real background in astronomy, but no place to apply that background. And he gave them a chance to send in their observations and be part of a big, important project.
This is going to sound ungracious to Mr. Pickering, but they were cheap labor, too, weren't these women?
Yes, women still are in many cases.
They're very true, yeah.
But the opportunity he gave them, the confidence he placed in them, and the recognition he brought them, all of those were recompense. They did complain about their salary sometimes, mm-hmm. but they were happy to have the work.
Hmm. World War II comes along, NASA comes along, and space exploration. This all plays into that as well.
Yes, there were people from the Harvard Observatory who showed how well their background in astronomy had trained them to do war work. So the wife of the observatory director was computing ballistics tables for the Navy. Hmm. There were many ways that a trained astronomer could participate and contribute.
Describe for me what it was like to look at these plates. I'm going to guess you've been up to Harvard and seen these glass plates.
I have. They're beautiful things. They look like a little like museum relics.
Yeah, which they are, I suppose, right?
They are. They are. They started in 1885, and they cover a full century of the night sky. So the last one was taken in 1992.
Wow.
And that's what makes the collection so extraordinary, because although digital techniques now can do more, see farther, they can't see what's on those plates. So today, new discoveries can be better understood by looking back and seeing what was in those same sectors of the sky 100 years ago.
All thanks to these underpaid and underappreciated women who worked in the Harvard College Observatory.
Much thanks to them. Great thanks to Pickering, too,
and
to Mrs. Draper for providing the money.
For the money, of course. David Sobel's most recent book is called The Glass Universe, about the ladies of Harvard Observatory. David, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
This final note on the way out today, file under making the best of an irritating situation. Politico is reporting that the New York real estate agency Douglas Elliman is advertising a $1.2 million, 1,000-square-foot condo in Trump Tower in Manhattan, thusly, quote, Fifth Avenue buyers interested in Secret Service protection?
the best value in the most secure building in Manhattan, the new amenity, the United States Secret Service. Well, shoot, we got to go. The Dow up 35 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 24 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 put on 7 points, about 0.3% there. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.